Live from the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. Google Fiber's hyperspeed internet and other technological advances can shape businesses in Kansas City and other metro areas for the better, but only if they're used in the right way. This hour, we'll talk with speakers in town for the City Age New American City Conference about leveraging technology to the advantage of cities. Later, we'll shift our focus to transportation. We'll look at how managing public transit and traffic flow is vital to the success of city planning. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date. Steve Kraske is away this week. I'm Brian Ellison. We're coming to you live from the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, which has been home yesterday and today to City Age, a summit on the future of the American city. It's brought together leaders, experts, and visionaries from across the nation for networking and conversations about new ideas in business, government, and society. Last hour, Central Standard brought you a conversation on urban renewal. This hour, we're talking about a question Kansas City has wrestled with for years, bringing transportation systems into the 21st century. That's in the second half of our show. But first, another topic dear to local hearts, technology, hyperspeed internet, and the life of the city. We're very pleased to have joining us Mike Burke, longtime servant of the city of Kansas City, and co-chair of the mayor's Bi-State Innovation Team and part of this conference today. Mike, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here. It's been a very exciting couple of days.
It has indeed. We're hoping to be joined in a moment by the mayor of Chattanooga, Tennessee, Ron Littlefield, who is on one of the panels speaking on this subject today. Chattanooga, like Kansas City, two cities that are trying to make use of hyperspeed internet, Mike. What's the latest on that in Kansas City's context?
Well, the latest in Kansas City is we now have homes hooked up. I was just at a meeting with the head of Google Fiber, Milo Medine, who's in town for the conference, and he said they actually got their first bills out, 140 bills.
Wow!
To homes that have been hooked up to Google Fiber, and this is truly very exciting time for Kansas City, and the eyes of the world are on Kansas City.
Now, how many neighborhoods are already wired?
Well, just one, which is the Hanover Heights area, and that's where a number of people have bought homes, what we call the Hacker Homes and Hacker Village and Digital Village. And actually, some of those people are here today, one who just moved to Kansas City. Okay. From Denver, just to take advantage of the speed of the fiber that's here. They will shortly start another neighborhood in Kansas City, Kansas, Dubs Dred, and then shortly after the first of the year on the Missouri side.
Now, Google Fiber is just one of the many sort of parts of the way that Kansas City is embracing innovation and technology. You've been working on this very closely with other leaders from around the region. Tell us some of the things that you think are most exciting going on in Kansas City.
Well, a number of really important takeaways. One is speed alone is not going to solve our problems. It's not where we need to head. Matter of fact, in our report, which we did, or the playbook, which we gave to the two mayors, we pointed out that it's about 90% sociology and 10% technology, and by that we mean it's the big story is not about Google Fiber, it's about Kansas City, and what we as a city are willing to do to take the lead as the digital crossroads of the country.
And let's talk specifically about that. What are we willing to do? I mean, does this involve tax breaks? Does it involve financial incentives? Does it involve an attitude shift? What is it that it takes?
I think the attitude shift, a couple of very significant developments. One is the initiation of something we call Launch KC, which is an economic development program aimed at startups, tech startups, and providing them some of the tools they need. One of the interesting things, my background is in economic development and land use, and the old models don't work. The old models, you know, economic development is building something, building a building, developing real estate. In the new model, it's about creativity. It's about bringing talent to Kansas City. And I know what Mayor Littlefield will mention as far as Chattanooga's experience is that the cities which can grow, nurture, keep, capture, and steal talent in the next decade are the cities that are going to prosper.
Besides Chattanooga, are there other cities that you would regard as sort of real leaders in this arena?
There's some other cities that have fiber. Kansas City is the only city with Google Fiber, and it's a significant difference because of the business model and because of the television that comes with it.
Yeah.
And the way that Google has invested in our community.
Now, one of the things that does stand out to me about Chattanooga's model is that it really focuses on business. I mean, a lot of the hyperspeed internet is being put to business applications as well as utilities. Do you see a future where that's more what's happening in Kansas City, where that's really integrated into the existing infrastructure of the city?
Yes. Of course, in many parts of the city, high-speed fiber is available through other providers. Mm-hmm. So those businesses that needed, especially engineering, architectural, construction firms, healthcare, hospitals, are already wired for speed. The big difference with fiber to the home is it opens up whole new areas of applications, of experimentation. And I think that's what you'll see happening in Kansas City over the next few years. One of the interesting things that we are looking forward to opening here after the first of the year is a project that the Innovation Center at UMKC has helped put together, and we went after, as did 80 other cities, a federal grant for what's called a Proof of Concept Center. Proof of Concept Center is where we can take some of these applications that people come up with and really work with leaders in the business community, the finance community, and the academic community to see what works. I have a feeling, and our goal is to develop 10 new businesses out of that Proof of Concept Center in the next 2 years.
You know, I wonder, Mike, a lot of this seems like such a no-brainer for a city to invest in these things and to do these things. Where do you find resistance? Where do you encounter pushback on taking these steps to move forward as a city?
Well, I think it's not necessarily resistance as maybe a lack of realization of what this can do for our city. There are a number of areas where Kansas City does need to step up. One is in the area of venture capital funding. It's an area we're paying some attention to.
Yeah.
We're working on some legislation in the Missouri legislature for angel investor tax credit. And we made some progress with that last year, and it overwhelmingly passed the House, but didn't go anywhere in the Senate. We feel much better this year.
We're pleased to be joined right now by Mayor Ron Littlefield from the city of Chattanooga, Tennessee. That's a city that has seen a resurgence of business and industry with the help of technology. Mayor Littlefield, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be with you. I apologize for being a little late. I was up in the stratospheric seat in
Yes.
this beautiful facility here in Kansas City.
Well, as we all say here, there's not a bad seat in the House.
No.
Just takes a little longer to get down to the radio show.
And I was listening to the Kansas City mayor, and it would have been rude for me to walk out while he was talking.
Well, we appreciate your coming by. Thank you for being here. Might want to mention to our listeners that we're not able to take phone calls today, but you can still be part of the conversation by email at uptodate@kcur.org or by posting a comment on KCUR's Facebook page. We'd love to have you be part of the conversation. Ron Littlefield, we've heard a lot about technology in this city with the Google Fiber Project and hyperspeed internet and its impact, but Chattanooga, Tennessee already has invested a lot in hyperspeed internet. Tell us a little bit about Gig City.
Well, actually, about $300 million, but it was one of those things where a convergence of fortunate events and one unfortunate event made it all happen, the unfortunate event being the downturn in the national economy. But Chattanooga had already made the decision to invest in building a fiber optic system to help support and manage our electrical system. We have a municipal utility, the Electric Power Board, which is city-owned. And just as we began to build out that system, and this was for fiber to every house and business, 160,000 customers of that facility, that company, if you will. And just as the economy went bad, they made stimulus money available, and so we applied for and received a very large stimulus grant to enable us to build it out faster and to serve the underserved, the areas that are difficult to serve. So anyway, we got there before Google.
Yeah, and so
but we're happy to see what's going on here.
Well, and of course, things are things have happened, had a very concrete impact on business, right? You've attracted new businesses as well as enhancing the businesses you already have.
Not only attracting businesses, I mean, we would have to think that the availability of that kind of broadband assistance was one reason that Amazon chose to build a rather significant fulfillment center there in Chattanooga, employing thousands of people, particularly right now, Christmas time. We have invested in the quality of our life. We are an old industrial city. We were the dirtiest city in America in October of 1969. Walter Cronkite told the world that. Mm-hmm. And so we have been building back from that low point ever since. And quality of life and building for the future, and we feel like that fiber optics, such as you are building now here in the Kansas City area, and as we have in Chattanooga, is the future of technology and the future types of infrastructure that will be needed for cities.
I'm curious for both of your reactions. The reality is that this wouldn't happen without significant funding from the local government. In the case of Chattanooga, there's a certain federal government element, right, through U.S. Ignite. There's corporate partners. What part of that comes most easily, and what of that is most difficult? What's most important in the process?
Well, it's, you know, we have a great advantage because we have one private corporation wiring our entire city, and that's Google. And they've never said how much they're investing, but I think it's probably upwards of $500 million in our city, and that is a huge private investment. We've been having discussions with other gigabit cities around the world, Barcelona and Amsterdam and Moscow and Toronto. And what you find out is they have playbooks and plans similar to ours, similar to Chattanooga's, except their play number one or their chapter number one is let's invest hundreds of millions of dollars of public dollars into our infrastructure. We're blessed to have that being done for us by Google.
Mm-hmm. Mayor Littlefield?
Well, in Chattanooga, the system was built based on a very careful and comprehensively developed business plan. The Electric Power Board has a board of five individuals that have one thing in common, and that is that they're all recognized in the community as strong business people, private business people, drawn from the political right and the political left, and they everything in between with those five individuals. It's racially and politically diverse for a small board. And I tell everyone when they agree on something, I know it has to do with business and not with politics or anything else that sways the community. And so they analyzed this business plan and said this will work simply from the standpoint of making the system work better, the electrical distribution system. And so we built it on that basis. We could show the numbers that it would pay for itself, and it has already begun to do so. We had a storm in July that knocked 80,000 people out of service and 40,000 went back online in 2 seconds. So that makes a big difference.
You know, one of the things I'd like to talk about is the impact of technology on communities, and particularly with regard to the digital divide, as it sometimes is called. You've got different levels of access to technology and to all the benefits and blessings that brings to a community at different socioeconomic levels. How are both of your cities, Kansas City as well as Chattanooga, addressing that very real problem? Mike?
I just left a meeting of all of our area librarians, and that's something near and dear to their heart. They understand the library has always been in the information business and will continue to do so. I think that is where a lot of people who otherwise don't have access to either a computer or to the Internet will be looking. The other place is our schools, and I think, you know, I feel strongly every student from middle school on should have their own computer. And I think a lot of our school districts are figuring this out and have moved in that direction. We have a long way to go to really integrate the Internet teaching into our school systems. It involves, in many cases, retraining teachers. But the digital divide issue, not only is it a divide currently, but we could build ourselves into a situation of a high-speed digital divide.
So we have high-speed and low-speed. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. That was Mike Burke, who, among other things, is co-chair of the Mayor's Bi-State Innovation Team. And we're also talking with Mayor Ron Littlefield of Chattanooga, Tennessee. How about the digital divide in Chattanooga?
Well, I couldn't have set that up any better. I just walked up and met Mike, and he was talking about libraries. And in Chattanooga, well, first of all, let me say I'm 66, so I'm on the wrong side of that digital divide. I'm one of those people that used to, you know, a baby boomer, used to laugh at my parents because they couldn't set the VCR. Now I am my parents. I'm in that position. And so in Chattanooga, we realize that we have a generation that is probably ahead of the generation that's presently in positions of influence, and we want to listen to them and see what they bring to the table. And so our library is playing a very central role in that. We have a library that was built in the mid-70s. If you walked into it, you'd think that you were on a set of Mad Men or something like that. But we've embraced that. We even brought back shag carpeting. We've made it kind of cool because the 70s are cool again. And the one floor in the library that was never developed, that was just used for storage, is now being used for digital technology. We have all kinds of gatherings there of young people and so forth. I was there just the other day, and there were all kinds of screens lit up all around, and more computers than I would have ever thought would be in the library in one place. So that and our own schools, our public schools, are an important part of getting our community attuned with the generation that's going to be taking over the reins very soon.
So let me ask you, Mayor Littlefield, you've worked in city planning and public works even before you were an elected official.
And, right.
And I'm curious about the politics of all this. If you want to pull something like this off politically, as well as from an administrative standpoint in a city, how do you find the will to do it? How do you get the players together?
Chattanooga has the benefit of being a city that was pretty far down on its luck for a long time, and then we began to hit some home runs after we made a decision to make the city a more livable place, and then we succeeded in attracting Volkswagen. Those Passats that you see running around are all made in Chattanooga, and several other major investments. So then the real key then was tying something to our future. Now, we are not like other communities. We do not have to present these sorts of questions for referendums, and I have to say that it would be a very difficult thing politically to get people to buy into a $300 million bond issue for digital technology. I've talked to some other mayors here at a gathering, and they've told me the difficulties they've had with that, but we did have the ability, being a municipally owned utility operated like a private company by private business people, to be able to do it without significant criticism. And I'm happy to say that it's working very well.
Mike?
One of the things that I'll say about Chattanooga is it takes dedicated and wise leadership to take your city into the future the way Chattanooga has. And I'm a big fan of not only the mayor but urban planners, because they're looking to the future. And we're very fortunate in Kansas City, Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas, to have two mayors who not only like each other and work well together, but share that same vision, Mayor James and Mayor Reardon. And I think I've got to give a shout out to the political leadership that understands and literally gets it, that the future is something you embrace.
That's Mike Burke, who is co-chair of the Mayor's Bi-State Innovation Team. We are also joined by Mayor Ron Littlefield of Chattanooga, Tennessee. We're out of time, but I really appreciate both of you being here with us today. Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
We'll take another look at a hot topic on the future of the American city. This one included transportation, highways and bridges, too many polluting cars, light rail proposals one after another, the revival of a trolley. What are the answers? We'll talk about that coming up. Also later this hour, a talk here at the home of the Kansas City Symphony with its executive director about when to clap at a concert and when not to. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's program, where we talked about the culture, joys, and ethics of hunting with writer and outdoorsman Stephen Ranella, you can find that online at kcur.org. And be sure to join us tomorrow when we'll talk with mathematician Sam Arbisman about spelling and virtual athletes. That's tomorrow at 11. We're coming to you live today from the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. It's home of the Kansas City Symphony, and in a few minutes we'll talk with the symphony's executive director about a question that came up over the weekend about when patrons should clap and when they shouldn't. But first, the real reason that we're here, the City Age Conference on the New American City, and a conversation that will happen here this afternoon on the challenges facing cities in the realm of transportation. Joining me are Marcia Anderson-Bomar. She's senior principal of Stantec, and for 20 years she ran her own transportation engineering and design consulting firm. Welcome to you, Marcia.
Thank you very much.
And also Roger Millar, Senior Vice President of Smart Growth America. They work with cities on transportation and neighborhood issues. Welcome to you, Roger.
Great. Well, thanks to be here.
Marcia, let me start with you. Bridges and roads, even trains and streetcars, that's the stuff that cities have been all about for as long as there have been cities. So what's new in transportation in the new American city?
Okay, I think one of the things that's new is the philosophy. There is no one solution that will make the cities work well, but we do know that great cities need a strong public transit backbone. Public transit looks very different today than it did when I was growing up. You have many more types of public transport, much more extensive systems in the successful cities, but you also have a lot of technology. You have called flex technology. We have zip cars, we have segways, we have a lot of tools to help people get to the spines, to the public transport systems.
And Roger, living in Kansas City, it seems like we've had more than our fair share of transportation issues. We've got bridges that divide the city across the river. We're contemplating a major airport renovation. We've voted for light rail plans more than once that haven't come to be yet. Are we unusual in having so much public discourse about transportation issues?
Not at all. Not at all. People want choice. You know, we're in the smart growth business. What we're talking about is providing housing and transportation choices for people near job, shopping, and schools. And people get it. Sometimes their elected officials are a little behind the curve, but people get it. They want choices about how they get around. They don't want to be stuck with the automobile as their only choice any more than they want to be stuck with walking or biking or taking transit as their only choice. They want a menu that they can pick from to meet their needs, depending on the particular situation.
Well, let's talk about some of those choices and kind of the implications for them and how those choices are changing in this day and age. I also want to invite our listeners to join the conversation. You can do that by email at uptodate@kcur.org, or you can tweet at us. We're at @KCURUpToDate. Marcia, I mentioned light rail, one of the things we talked a lot about here in Kansas City. More recently, there's some talk about a trolley or a streetcar line. What are the things the city needs to know as it contemplates those kind of mass transit options?
Okay, I think that one of the things that has to happen is that you have to have a united voice. I think there are big investments to bring some of these transport options to the city. And certainly at the federal level, there is no appetite to come into a community that is not singing off the same sheet of paper. We experienced that down in Atlanta, where we did get a Tiger grant for a streetcar system. And when the Secretary of Transportation came to Atlanta, he said it was because everybody came together and rallied around that project. And there was not divided community. So I think that's really important.
So how do you bring that about, though? What if a community's government leaders or its business leaders are already divided? I mean, what brings them together on the issue?
Well, you have to start looking down the road. You have to create a vision for what is possible if you're successful. And then you have to build the constituencies. You have to have a lot of small local conversations. And then it's like we're here in the Symphony Hall. It's like a concert. You have to build to a crescendo. Hmm. But you have to have some leadership, strong leadership that can paint that vision, that can help facilitate some of those conversations. And in this day and age, you have to have a strong business plan. You know, nobody wants to invest, even if they're public dollars, if they're not sure that it's going to bring value to a community.
You say that the federal government has no appetite for getting involved. How much of this sort of these major innovations, these major projects, how dependent are they on federal dollars? How much are states able to kick in at this point? And how much of it is just coming up from the local mm-hmm. level?
It used to be very strongly federally driven. That's decreasing hourly.
Yeah. yes, every day we read the newspaper.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So, you know, states and local governments are becoming more creative in the kinds of tools that they're establishing. We have special purpose local option sales tax programs where communities choose to tax themselves to pay for transportation projects. We have regional programs that are being created to create pools of money to invest in these large projects because we feel like we can't rely on the big dollars coming in from the federal government anymore. So there are innovative financing tools. Public-private partnerships are one, but there are many, many different types of tools that can be stimulated at the local level.
Roger, Kansas City prides itself on some of its distinctive neighborhoods, and I know that you've done a lot of work with neighborhoods and connecting them and the relationships among them. What are some of the implications for these different transportation choices, the impact it has both on connecting the different parts of a city and also on sort of maintaining distinct neighborhood identities?
Well, that's the chicken and egg question that comes up all the time. You know, land use, we think, really should take the lead, and transportation should follow. If you look at what we've done, you know, during the interstate era, we connected our cities, we connected our country, we connected our freight movement, but we also divided communities, these huge corridors cutting through urban neighborhoods, cutting through central business districts, and dividing towns. And so what you need to look at is what makes sense for the community in question. You know, the notion of, well, the latest hot technology, we want it to be a streetcar, we want it to be this or that or the other. Technology is great, but it has to be applied in a way that makes sense in the community in question. You know, when we did the streetcar in Portland, I was the project manager on that project. It wasn't about a streetcar. It was about, we have an urban university, we have an urban hospital, we have urban neighborhoods, we have a central business district, we have close-in residential areas. How do we connect those folks up in a way that costs us the least amount of money, and provides what people are looking for. And if it adds a little pizzazz, great.
Right. I'm curious, are you familiar with the streetcar or trolley proposal that's being
I know that Kansas
about?
City is one of many communities that's been talking about a streetcar.
Yeah, sometimes it does sound like the question is whether it's the pizzazz or the actual movement of people that is being emphasized.
Well, going back to what Marcia said about the business case, we made a business case that the streetcar made sense in Portland. The initial project was 100% locally funded, $56 million project. There's been a $4 billion private investment along that corridor since the project opened. And, you know, the investments were being made prior to the construction of the project. That's a huge return on the investment for the community. The things we talk about are good ideas, but they have to be good deals to be successful.
We're talking today about transportation, coming to you live from the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, talking at the City Age Conference on the New American City. I'm Brian Ellison, and this is Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking with Marcia Anderson-Bomar of Stantec and Roger Millar of Smart Growth America. I want to talk a bit with a couple other panelists. All four of our guests today will be on a panel this afternoon on these subjects here at this conference. Our other guests are both examples, leaders of examples of innovation in transportation. And so I want to welcome Zia Yusuf. He's the CEO of Streetline. Welcome to you, Zia.
Great to be here.
And also Bill Knapp. He's the Chief Operating Officer of Car2Go down in Austin. Welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Zia, let me start with you. What is Streetline? Tell us what it is.
Sure. So if you've ever had a problem finding a parking spot, we have a solution for you. 25 to 30% of the traffic in the city, believe it or not, is caused by people looking for parking. And so what we do is we put out sensors on the ground in each parking spot on the street.
Actual electronic sensors.
So that's a magnetic sensor. It goes about half an inch into the ground, and then there's a mesh network that comes on top of it. And those sensors detect the presence of a car. That creates new data and information on occupancy. This data then can be used by the city to manage that space. A parking spot is a real estate asset, and we look at the economics of that real estate asset. How do you price it? What should the ticketing be on it? And how should a city manage that real estate and very strategic asset, actually? And then, of course, for consumers, we take that same information. We have a Parker app. You can get the information other ways as well. We will give you real-time information on where those open parking spots are so we can guide you to that spot where there's an open parking spot.
So I'm driving in my car. I've got my little map open.
Yes.
And there's a red dot at every open parking space?
Yeah, so even though we know the status of every spot, we actually won't send you to a specific spot. We've created these three categories, less than 2, 2 plus, and 4 plus. So what you'll see on your map, you'll see your own dot as you go through the GPS. And you only see, okay, if I take a left, there's less than 2 spots. If I go straight, there's 2 plus. If I take a right, there's 4 plus spots. 2 plus and 4 plus, 100% guaranteed. And that's where people waste the time. They make that wrong choice on turning left and right.
And they have to go around the block.
And you also then, you know, can argue with your spouse based on fact as opposed to, you know, theory.
Now, why would a city sign up for this? Actually, you've been giving us some pretty good reasons why they might want to because of the congestion. Maybe the question is, why wouldn't they? What keeps this from being implemented in every city?
It's a good question. So just this morning, we're very fortunate to partner with companies like IBM and Siemens and Citibank and so on. And today we announced a partnership this morning with Cisco, including deploying our technology in San Mateo and San Carlos. It's a new topic, right? Most people have traditionally looked at traffic, which is kind of strange because the traffic information tells you it takes you 14.2 minutes to get from point A to point B. But point B may be outside a restaurant, outside a business. That's not your ultimate destination. Your ultimate destination is actually point C when you actually park your car. So this is a new space. This is this whole issue of smart city, smart technologies. And the adoption is increasing. We did about 30 deals this year across various cities and universities, by the way. Clemson, University of Oregon, University of Maryland. Because universities are like small towns. So parking is becoming one of those kind of killer apps from a technology perspective, both for consumers as well as municipalities.
We may want to connect you with the folks at UMKC here in town.
Happy to.
So that's Zia Youssef of Streetline. Bill Knapp of Car2Go, you've got another aspect of that. You want to help cause some of that congestion with folks having cars, right?
Well, actually, we have a system that we hope actually plays into that, reducing congestion.
Okay, tell us what Car2Go is.
Essentially what it is, it's an evolution of the traditional car sharing model where vehicles aren't station-based anymore. So essentially what you can do is we have a network of free-floating vehicles that are in a predefined home area. And typically a consumer would take a car from point A to point B, and then they would leave that vehicle. They would be done with their trip, and then now a new member can come in and take that vehicle from there.
And how does a person know where the cars are? What is this all internet-based?
We certainly rely on the internet. I mean, from the simple registration process, the first step, but the next step is finding a vehicle. They can do that online, or we have several applications that are built for smartphones. Person can go on, simply look at that application, find the next available vehicle. They usually walk one or two blocks, they get in the vehicle, and then they continue their trip.
So how many cities do you have this up and running?
Well, currently we're in 17 cities worldwide. In North America, we are in 8 cities, soon to be our 9th, which will be Seattle, Washington.
I guess the thing that just comes to mind is you would worry about availability. You would worry about the reliability of this. If I have a doctor's appointment, I can't take a chance on whether the car is there. How do you deal with that?
I mean, actually, it's a system that is self-optimizing. So essentially, we have a network, a density of vehicles within a pre-described home area. And say in a city, it's maybe an area of about 40 square miles. And then what would happen is we have 300 to 400 vehicles in that area. And the vehicles position themselves typically where people are needing transportation. So you may go to the doctor's office. Somebody's finishing their appointment there. That vehicle is available out on the street. They take that vehicle.
Yeah, it sounds quite remarkable. Let me ask Roger and Marcia, I mean, how big a problem is the congestion factor with cars in American cities? How big a problem is parking?
Oh, it's a huge problem. Actually, back in the 80s, as planners and engineers, we started studying that issue and did some pilot programs with some cities in the southeast looking at how information technology could improve the speed with which folks could find parking, which would reduce that recirculation. The technology just wasn't quite there yet to support that. Some of the technology that's now used in traffic signal systems, the intelligent transportation system technology, was what was the baseline at the time for the approach to providing that information. But now that you have smartphones, you don't have to have a littering of the landscape with signage on the street that says, you know, how many
parking spaces
are available here and there. You have those typically at airports or other very large facilities, but for the average motorist, that's really not a great tool. It's too late by the time you see that sign. So having smart technology in your hand was really, I think, a turning point for making that viable.
Is this safe? I'm thinking particularly the street line, Zia. Is it safe to have people looking at their phones while trying to find a parking space and doing all this?
So it's no different than your typical navigation app. There's absolutely nothing you need to do in terms of interaction with the app once you switch it on. You visually see it. There is also voice guidance in there. Hmm. So it will tell you, you know, there's 3 parking spots on the left, 4 on the right. We've also started discussions with a whole host of auto manufacturers because ultimately this belongs in in-car navigation when you put in your address and you get guided to that spot.
So Bill, I'm curious with Car2Go, have you had enough experience to sort of draw conclusions about whether this is actually reducing congestion? Are fewer people actually owning cars in the city because of programs like this?
Absolutely. I think it's, you know, lots of studies have shown that traditional car sharing reduces the amount of private vehicle ownership, anywhere between 10 and 20 vehicles for every shared vehicle.
Wow.
And Car2Go has similar results from our members. We hear consistently that people are giving up their single car, or multiple car families that live in the city are making the choice to have more income to spend on other things in the city and not that second second car in the second parking spot.
Roger Millar, are cities themselves actually encouraging programs like this? Do cities see these as just sort of businesses trying to make a buck, or is this actually part of urban planning now?
I think smart cities are. I think when you look at the car-to-go model, the car-sharing model, that savings to a family means a family can do something else. They can live in better housing. They can educate their kids. They can save for retirement. There are a lot of good public policy reasons for that. And it goes back to giving people choices. It's wonderful to see the automobile kept relevant as our society evolves through the application of technology. You know, when back to the streetcar, one of our big critics in Portland used to argue that the streetcar is an obsolete technology. And I would point out to him that the streetcar was invented the same year as the automobile. The great thing that's happening with technology is it's not just being applied to the automobile, it's being applied to everything we do. There are apps that help when you're walking, there are apps that help when you're biking, there are apps that help when you take transit. And we combine all of that with thinking about not just how we get from here to there, but where here and there are relative to one another, so that we can reduce people's costs, we can give them more options for how they spend their time. It's a real rich mix of things going on.
I'm curious if there are other innovations you're aware of, and I'll ask our businessmen here whether there's any competitors they admire or other folks, innovations that you think are the next big thing, and also our experts on what are you seeing that's having a real impact, new innovations in technology, things we wouldn't have seen 10, 15 years ago.
There are companies out there that are capturing data from cellular companies. They're sanitizing the data so there's no proprietary information being shared, but they're using that to feed the real-time traffic systems. Vehicles that are on the road already are serving as probes, so you can have a much better idea sooner about what the conditions are, so that you can make better choices about if you are driving, where to go.
Marcia, is that what I'm seeing on say, Google Maps or something? If it's green, it's because the phones are moving at a certain speed. If it's yellow,
it depends what city. Yeah,
okay.
But some of them are driven by those databases. Some are driven by databases where most often the state government has a transportation management center, mm-hmm. where they're collecting their own data through cameras, through probes in the ground, and sometimes supplemented with those auto data.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the technology is fundamentally changing the need to travel. That's one of the things that we're seeing is we've got a generation now, Generation Y, that would rather text than drive. You know, people are getting their driver's license later than they used to. People are choosing not to own a car, where we used to always assume that was what we were going to do. The technology is enabling us to connect to one another without taking that drive. The technology is enabling us to live in places where we don't need a car, where, again, we can have choices about how we move around. So I think there's technological solutions in all of the modes, but what's really interesting is how people are responding to it in how they choose to spend their time, and they spend less of their time on the road.
Yeah, in our last segment, when we were talking about technology in cities, one of our guests said it's 90% sociology and 10% technology, and it sounds like that's the same in the transportation world as well. Zia?
Yeah, I think the big change is information, right? The collection of information in ways that was not possible before, from the street, from the car, from your phone, and then dissemination for that information. There's a tremendous amount of, in the last couple of years, startup activity in the transportation sector, which is new. Usually it's been the larger companies that have kind of done something. And you've got a slew of startups, Car2Go, ourselves. Waze is one that's very good on traffic. Park Mobile does mobile payments for parking and so on. And that's going to change things, as it has in many other industries. And some of these will work, some of them will not work. But the pace of change will definitely accelerate.
Any other innovations we should be keeping an eye out for, Bill?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody here has hit on some of the topics. I mean, choices are what consumers want. And I think some of the most innovative companies right now are the ones that are looking at how do we, you know, aggregate all of those choices for a consumer of transportation, and be it, you know, do we put out something that shows the public transit routes, you know, go, you can find Car2Go, you can find a taxi, you can find a limo through a service like Uber, and the ones that are going to combine that information and make that available and provide those choices in one single platform are really the companies that are, I think, on the cutting edge.
One last question that is really only indirectly a transportation question. Does the impact of the growing number of people who are telecommuting, who are not needing transportation to get to work at all, does that change how cities and governments are thinking about transportation today?
It changes travel patterns. You've got to remember that commuting is only about, what, 20% of the total number of trips that are out there. People that telecommute have more opportunities to go do those other trips. And so what it means is that the travel is dispersed over the day. It's dispersed over the geography. It's different than what it used to be. And if you put your transportation system together around a traditional suburb to central city commute pattern, that's going away. It's becoming more 24/7, and it's becoming from every place to every place. So you've got to provide, again, the choices from every place to every place.
And there are a lot of other things that are affecting that. You have so many more two-career families that are making different kinds of decisions about where they want to live and who does the long commute, or do they split the commute. With the proliferation of baby boomers, some choosing to retire and having different kinds of patterns, or choosing to work longer and work part-time. And so they're part of that group that's commuting off-peak. So you're absolutely right, Roger, that there's so much about revisiting why people are traveling. What are the trip purposes? How many people are carpooling? We're doing a lot with technology in taking advantage of those people who want to carpool in larger numbers, or who are willing to pay for a reliable trip, like the hot lanes, the high occupancy toll lanes.
But you know, the interesting thing is, with all this new technology, the data shows that the number of cars on the street is going up dramatically. Mm-hmm. The congestion is going up dramatically. New York City sold its first $1 million parking spot, and congestion in China went into days in a certain area. So cars are here to stay.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but really interesting conversation. This was a bit of a dress rehearsal for the panel that's on later this afternoon here at the City Age Conference. Bill Knapp, Zia Youssef, Roger Millar, and Marcia Anderson Bomar, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, when to clap at the symphony and when not to. So were you tempted to applaud just then? This is Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison. Joining us as we sit here in the Brandmeier Hall, just outside Helzberg Hall, is the Kansas City Symphony's Executive Director, Frank Byrne. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes with us.
Brian, always a pleasure.
So what happened a couple of weeks ago at the Symphony that has given rise to this profound conversation about applause?
Well, it's something that happens from time to time, but last Sunday there was a letter to the editor of the Kansas City Star, someone speaking about our performance of Beethoven's Sixth Symphony.
Which we just heard a little of.
Yes, you did. And on one of the nights, I think it was Saturday night, after the first and second movements, people clapped. And our guest conductor, Osmovenska, acknowledged it, and the person who wrote the letter said, you know, he was obviously annoyed. And it's interesting because I talk about this with people, and I posted it on my Facebook page, my personal Facebook page, along with a little survey monkey, and Maestro Venska posted on my page, hey, it doesn't bother me, so why should it bother anyone else?
Well, and so maybe we should just review for our listeners, what is the convention? Why do people not applaud sometimes and applaud at others?
Well, I think that the problem is that sometime in the early 20th century, it was thought that musical performances should be more like going to church or something, and more of a very controlled atmosphere. And they wiped out a couple of centuries of tradition where people clapped all the time, mm-hmm. not only at the end of movements, but during the middle of movements. And Mozart and other people talked about that in letters that we can read today.
But after a big solo or
of course,
a big cadenza.
And they would even yell da capo. They wanted to play the movement again. You know, it was a very freewheeling thing. But it's become a lot more restrictive. And the fact is, you know, personally, would I rather that people wait until the very end of the piece? Yes. And on our symphony website, in terms of information for concert goers, we let people know that the most appropriate time to applaud is at the end. But the question is, if someone comes in that might be a new listener, a new audience member, and they applaud out of sincere appreciation for what's going on, should we scold them? And I think that the answer is no.
Yeah, I guess I'm. If I'm, let's pick somewhere that's maximally snooty. If mm-hmm. I'm in Avery Fisher Hall and at the New York Philharmonic, and I fall asleep during the second movement, and I wake up with a start, and I hear that the music stopped, and I start clapping, what are people around me likely to do in that environment?
Well, I think glare. They may shush you. They may do other things. But you know, I always feel that when we have clapping that occurs at non-standard times, it's a signal that there are new people in the hall.
And you regard it as a good thing.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I would prefer that they wait until the end. But if they do it out of a sincere appreciation for what they're hearing, the last thing I want to do is to send the signal to a new person, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
You can't show your appreciation in that way or, you know, somehow scold them, because I want them to feel that the symphony is a welcoming place.
Well, I love that the symphony put this question on its Facebook page and invited people to comment, and you've had a lot of responses.
Yes, we have. As when I checked the results yesterday, I did a little Survey Monkey,
yes.
And it was 81% of people said, you know, we don't encourage people to applaud, but if they do, we understand and we acknowledge their expression of appreciation.
Some of my favorite comments, you had Rhoda, who wrote on your Facebook page about her own experience and said she was happy that patrons were filling the seat at Kaufman. She said, I sat next to a father anticipating his young teen clapping between movements, and he subtly placed his hand on hers as a quiet message.
Hmm.
But then she says, I don't recommend this for the person next to you unless you know them. Linda wrote on your Facebook page, I'm not a fan of clapping between movements. However, when Yo-Yo Ma was here last year, it was impossible not to clap after each movement, as it was the most beautiful performance I'd ever heard.
Well, some of this is the composer's fault. When a composer, as in the Dvorak Cello Concerto, with a giant end to the first ending, you know, first movement, rather, a giant ending, I mean, it's not anybody's fault. Of course
right.
You're going to applaud.
It
same thing after the
for applause.
First movement of the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto or things like that, yeah.
Another one from David, who I believe sings in the symphony chorus, if I'm understanding this right.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I've decided that for me at least, worrying about applause can be counterproductive. Last year, I ruined a Vienna symphony concert for myself by obsessing over audience applause between movements of a Brahms symphony. It wasn't worth it.
Well, that's true. And a number of composers and conductors have said, you know, we don't want people to feel so restricted. And I think that while this has become a convention, and it is best if the mood is kept, you know, during the middle movements of a piece. If someone does it, we're not going to remove them from the hall.
So will anything change after all this dialogue, all this discussion? Are you going to add it to your pre-concert speech?
No, I don't think so. I think we, you know, if we do anything, we might put something in the program book, basically mirroring what is already on our website. But no, I mean, at the end of the day, we want people to feel welcome. We want them to feel that this is their place as well. And if they are just telling us thank you, we want to thank them back.
That's Frank Byrne, Executive Director of the Kansas City Symphony. Thanks so much for being here with us.
My pleasure.
It's fun to be in your home, Helzberg Hall. We're glad you were here. You can find more information about all of our guests on today's show at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR, up to date. Tomorrow on the program, a talk with mathematician Sam Arbisman about the role of chance in everyday life, about the many ways to spell Hanukkah, and why in the future we might replace athletes with virtual sports. Our thanks to City Age and the Kauffman Center for hosting our broadcast today. It's been a good 2 hours together with Central Standard. We had help from KCUR's Chris Pruitt, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, Julie Deneche, and Matthew Long Middleton. Our show's senior producer is Steven Steigman. From the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts in Kansas City, I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.